tico-tico, tanta outra vez aqui. O tico-tico tá comendo meu fubá. Se o tico-tico tem que se alimentar, que vai comer o mais melhor, quero fumar. O tico-tico, tico-tico, tanta outra vez aqui. O tico-tico tá comendo meu fubá. Se o tico-tico tem que se alimentar, que vai comer o mais melhor, quero fumar. Mas por favor, desse bicho do canal.
One contemporary described the Stork Club as symbolizing and epitomizing the deluxe upholstery of quintessentially urban existence. It means fame, it means wealth, and it means an elegant way of life among celebrated folk. Beneath its elegant surface, however, writes our guest today, there dwelled a decidedly less glamorous, even seamier side of life. Our guest is Ralph Blumenthal, who led a Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the New York Times and is the author of Stork Club, America's Most Famous Nightclub in the Lost World of Cafe Society, published by Little Brown. Welcome, Ralph.
Thank you, Brian.
Get us started for the benefit of those listeners who may not be familiar with the Stork Club or even with Cafe Society by giving us a brief history of both the club and cafe life in America.
Sure. The Stork Club opened during Prohibition in New York around 1929, at a time when, as Will Rogers said, you know, Prohibition is better than no liquor at all. It opened as a speakeasy by Sherman Billingsley, a bootlegger from Oklahoma, and it lasted actually for a big momentous chunk of 20th century history. It lasted until the age of Aquarius, the Vietnam era, 1965, and obviously it flourished during the Depression and World War II, and we can talk about the reasons for that, but it took in this huge period of American history, and it became you know, the place to be. People came from all over the country, and stars and millionaires and captains of industry made it their home away from home.
It obviously went through many changes in American society. You know.
It did, and it prospered during the bad times and succumbed at a time of post-war prosperity.
Right, well, we'll want to talk about that, but first, your book it focuses on Sherman Billingsley, who's clearly a very interesting character. Tell us a little bit about
him. Yeah, it's interesting. His family went west in a covered wagon from Kentucky to Oklahoma in the land rush of the 1880s. He was actually born in Enid, Oklahoma in 1896, although he always claimed it was 1900. He liked to make himself 4 years younger, and he liked the idea of being born with the new century. But in one lifetime, you have the extraordinary prospect of a man whose family went west in a covered wagon and who ends up at the portals of, you know, the most gilded spot in New York well into the 20th century. So it's really a story of America. But Billingsley was a bootlegger who got his start in Oklahoma with his four brothers. At one point, they were the largest bootleggers in America. And they cut a swath from Oklahoma west to Washington State, through the Midwest, Nebraska, Michigan, and until they ended up in New York, where they opened up a bunch of drugstores, which was the perfect cover during Prohibition, because drugstores could legally get alcohol as medicine, and they converted that into booze for the speakeasies.
Well, clearly, the Stork Club wasn't a drugstore. You mentioned he opened it in 1929 and tied it into Prohibition here. What was the club like when it opened?
It opened in a small brownstone on West 58th Street, and he put a canopy over the sidewalk, which was interesting. It was a very brazen act for a speakeasy owner to do at a time when Prohibition agents were still raiding places. The club had music. It occupied several floors of this brownstone, and one story I tell in the book, there was of course a lot of competition, because in New York, as I said, in that era, you couldn't find a drink unless you walked 10 feet in any direction. There were plenty of other speakeasies, but Billingsley distinguished himself in various ways. One day, Heywood Bruin, the famous columnist for the Evening World, was out looking for a funeral he had to go to, and he passed the Stork Club, and it was so dark and unattended, he thought it was the funeral home. And he walked in looking for the body and found a bar instead, illegally, of course, during Prohibition. It had some drinks, liked the drinks, invited his friends, and that gave the Stork Club a big push.
Was it simply because of Prohibition, or was it Prohibition, to reword that, that attracted people into the Stork Club?
Well, Billingsley was a master marketer, even in those days. He knew how to attract people to his place. He He was totally devoted to his club, worked day and night. It was really the only thing that mattered to him, even more than the women he chased, and even more than the family he was also very devoted to. He sent telegrams to stars in Hollywood inviting him to the store club. He had coupons in the college newspapers for the young people to come in. He ended up putting the Stork logo on every possible product he could. He gave away liquor and ashtrays and suspenders and belts and pins and ties, all with the Stork Club image. So he was, you know, as I say, way ahead of the Nike swoosh in terms of self-marketing. And that was a real innovation.
Obviously, this self-marketing worked very well because he was able to survive the stock market crash and even Prohibition. But what was the Stork Club like after that, let's say, during the Depression years?
Well, he got raided in 1931, and he had to move. So he moved to another location, another brownstone, a townhouse on 51st Street. And that didn't turn out to be big enough. At the same time, he was fighting off some racketeers who had taken a big chunk of his business, and we can talk about that separately. But finally, he found the third location, which is the one people tend to remember, at 3 East 53rd Street, just off Fifth Avenue. And that was a doctor's office that he took over and eventually bought and built into the famous Stork Club. And that's the one you see in the movies with the canopy and the celebrities arriving in dark limousines. And that became the most famous one.
All right, well, you can't tease us like that and walk away from it. Tell us about the racketeers.
Okay. Billingsley, he came to New York as this bootlegger I told you, and he opened up a restaurant with two pals from Oklahoma. He thought he knew them pretty well. Turned out he didn't know them very well at all. They sold their interest quietly to somebody else, who turned out to be a front for three of the Prohibition's biggest gangsters. One was Oney the Killer Madden, who had a piece of the Cotton Club. Another was Big Frenchie Demange, who was a old leg breaker from the West Side. And another was Big Bill Dwyer, who was a big Prohibition rum runner. And the three of them decided that they really owned the Stork Club, and Billingsley was just his front, and he just could not get rid of them for the longest time. They siphoned money out of the Stork Club. They made him the front in other clubs that they owned. He claimed he had no choice. Billingsley himself was kidnapped by Mad Dog Cole, the crazy young gunman, who himself was shot in a phone booth later. Billingsley did manage to pay out his partners and break away, and from all indications I found in my research, he did run the third and final Stork Club on his own.
Ah, interesting story. In the 1940s, he seems to have survived the racketeers, and the Stork Club becomes it's at its height of glory during the 40s in terms of attracting celebrities. Tell us a little bit about
that. Yeah, it's interesting that during the war, the Stork Club became an icon for America. Soldiers were fighting all over the globe, and they looked back on the Stork Club as something they were fighting for in a strange way. The Stork logo was painted on bombers that flew missions over Germany. So American soldiers set up impromptu Stork Clubs on Pacific Islands in Germany. Because it was an image of home. And when they came home on leave, and even the commanders of the war, famous admirals and generals, would stop at the Stork Club for a drink, and they would sometimes diagram their military strategies on the tablecloths. And there was a doorman who was very concerned about this because he thought that when the tablecloths were sent to a Chinese laundry, it could fall into the hands of the enemy. So he would throw out these valuable tablecloths. But it became a sort of a symbol of America. And you might think that the people fighting in foreign, horrible foreign theaters of war would resent the fact that there was a place back home where people were dancing and having a good time, but it seemed to be the contrary. They looked back on that as one of the things they were fighting to save.
During the 50s and 60s, though, or actually probably during the 50s after the war, it really became a mecca for celebrities. Now, why would celebrities find the Stork Club so important?
Well, remember that television was in its very early stages, so there was really there was no virtual reality except maybe radio and movies, but reality was reality in those days. If you wanted to see somebody, you had to see them face to face. And celebrities wanted to be seen most of all. They didn't so much want to see other people, they wanted people to see them. So they went to a place where they knew they would meet other celebrities, and that was the Stork Club. Also, people from all over the country, visitors, did get into the Stork Club to ogle the celebrities. But it was sort of a giant meeting ground for the famous, and it just fed on itself. And there was no entertainment to speak of. There was dancing in the big room. But aside from orchestras that just followed each other in quick succession, there were no chorus girls, there were no singers. It was just a place for people to see each other and be famous.
So why did it not survive, to use your phrase, the age of Aquarius?
Well, first of all, television was a big blow. People were not going out at night so much. I mean, they were staying home and watching their flickering little black and white screens. This was quite a sensation. The growth of the suburbs had people working in town and then fleeing the city at the end of the day, getting on their buses and trains, so they weren't going to be around to go to a nightclub in the evening. The leisure class that the Stork Club depended on faded. Democratization had come in. People were the usual, the long-term divisions of society were being erased. So there wasn't this privileged class that would go to the Stork Club and everybody else would have to work. So it succumbed to the time, really. And ever since then, they've only been pale imitations. I mean, Studio 54 might have come the closest later, but there really has been no place like it since.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in your book, and talking about the demise of the Stork Club, union problems and problems of race. You want to just talk about those a bit?
Yeah. Billingsley had an uneasy relationship with the unions ever since he opened up the first Stork Club, and Dutch Schultz, the beer baron and big prohibition gangster, tried to muscle in on him with his corrupt restaurant unions. And Billingsley threw those racketeers out and always was bedeviled by labor problems, even when the union movement changed and unions became more honest and the corruption was controlled. He always had a vision of the unions as crooked. He paid his workers well enough, he thought, and they didn't need to join a union to make money. But when the rest of the country organized and labor unions became de rigueur, they still couldn't get into the Stork Club. So he was always being struck, and he had these running battles with unions. They would picket him, and he would go up on the roof of the Stork Club and bomb them with bags of water, which was not calculated to lead to a solution. He also bugged the Stork Club with microphones so he could listen to the staff plotting against him, which they did, and listen to his guests. And that's one of the revelations in the book, that the Stork Club was bugged with hidden microphones and two-way mirrors, and Billingsley listened on the internal phone lines. So the labor problems really killed him at the end, because a strike started in 1957 that never ended. Despite court rulings he won, they never stopped picketing him. And people just stopped going through the picket line. So that was one big nail in the coffin of the Stork Club. The other was race. Remember, in America before the Civil Rights Revolution, blacks had trouble getting into not only the Stork Club, but nightclubs in general, the best restaurants, medical schools, colleges, country clubs, golf clubs. This was a very different era, and obviously a very sad chapter in American life, but the Stork Club was by no means unique. The particular problem that occurred in 1951 was Josephine Baker, the flamboyant dancer and singer, had came to the Stork Club with some friends, was not promptly served, claimed she'd been snubbed, and stormed out and charged discrimination. In my book, I go into a great bit of detail laying out this episode. It's not the way it's been handed down by history. It was much more complicated than that. We don't really know what happened that night. Josephine may have gone with an agenda. It seems so. But either way, the historical truth is inescapable. These clubs were not hospitable to black Americans. And when that story got out, it proved, again, another nail in the Stork Club's coffin, and it could never escape the taint of racism.
Mm-hmm. In the minute we have left, the Stork Club was actually featured, or at least became part of, a number of Hollywood films. Maybe you could identify one of those and tell us how it was represented.
Sure. The most famous one is All About Eve with Bette Davis, which is set, a lot of scenes are set in the Stork Club, Bette Davis and Celeste Holm. It's a very good picture of the Stork Club. You really see it from the inside. Another is The Wrong Man, an Alfred Hitchcock movie with Henry Fonda, based on an actual case of a bass player at the Stork Club who was accused as a robber, misidentified by witnesses, and goes through hell before he's acquitted. It also figured in a movie, a very charming little musical called The Stork Club with Betty Hutton and Barry Fitzgerald. She's a hat check girl and saves the life of a millionaire, and not realizing he is a millionaire, gets him a job as a busboy in the Stork Club. It's very funny, lovely music. It's another indication of how the Stork Club became such an icon for popular culture, and it's been used as backdrops in many other films.
Well, it's a fascinating history of a very different era and an icon of that era. So we're out of time, however, so thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll come back again soon.
I'd love to, Brian. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ralph Blumenthal, author of Stork Club, America's Most Famous Night Spot in the Lost World of Cafe Society.